Hello. Surprise. I know we said we were signing off, but I spoke to a very special guest this week and I didn't want to wait until September to put the episode out. I'm Esther Thorpe, and this bonus episode features Nicholas Thompson, CEO of The Atlantic. We first spoke to Nicholas back in 2019 when he was editor-in-chief of Wired about what lessons he'd learned 1 year after introducing a paywall to the brand. Fast forward 5 years and Nicholas is now CEO at The Atlantic. Earlier this month, the publisher announced that not only had they met their 1 million subscriber goal, but they'd also reached profitability in an impressive turnaround. I had a wide-ranging conversation with Nicholas, from the paywall learnings he'd taken from previous roles to AI, Apple News Plus, and their newsletter programme. But before we get into the interview, a little reminder that we're just weeks out from the Publisher Podcast and Newsletter Summit on June the 12th in London. If you have a podcast and or a newsletter and are keen to take them to the next level, join us for a really focused day learning from industry-leading newsletters and podcasts of all shapes and sizes. Tickets, the draft agenda and more for both summits are up at publisherpodcasts.com. Right, without further ado, let's get back to Nicholas Thompson. I started by asking him what job he was brought on to do at The Atlantic and how he went about beginning transforming the business to reach those goals.
So when I was hired, I was given a very specific mandate, which is that the company was losing money and the ownership didn't want to lose any money anymore. And so they wanted a strategy that would get us to sustainability. And it was fairly clear, fairly early, that the core of the strategy would be trying to make the paywall more efficient and the consumer revenue number larger. Obviously, you want to improve your advertising numbers and sell better deals and get better margins, but the core of it was going to be working through how to optimize our consumer revenue strategy. So that's what we started in on. My team and I ran a bunch of experiments and some of them went pretty well.
Did some of them not go well?
I mean, of course. Yeah, lots of things went wrong. I mean, we could actually do a pretty good podcast on what were the things that I tried to do that failed? What were the experiments we ran that didn't work? You know, because when I came in, it's kind of interesting. I had thought that my initial instinct was that the way to make The Atlantic profitable would be, you know, improving the advertising business, improving the consumer business, but that a lot of it would come from launching a third revenue stream. And I wasn't sure what the third revenue stream would be. We ran a lot of experiments and we built out some models and we never actually built a significant third revenue stream. It just didn't happen. But what we did do is we, you know, almost tripled the amount of money that was coming in from the consumer revenue division, which is what, you know, led to the financial success.
And when you're experimenting with things like that, some experiments you need to give time to kind of really bed in, and some would have probably been evident fairly early on. What sort of runway do you give things when you're testing them in terms of seeing if they're going to actually work in the long term?
Well, it depends on the type of experiment. So we have run experiments on, you know, dozens and dozens of things, but just to give some categories, we run price tests. And so we'll test whether, you know, what happens if we offer people an Atlantic subscription for $60, $70, and $80, right? What is the subscription propensity? Okay, multiply it by lifetime value. Which one of these should we take? And you run that over the course of a month and you have a pretty specific answer, right? So let's say $70 wins, you know, over 60 and 80, then maybe you run a test again. Maybe you go 60, 70, 75, right? That's a fairly easy and simple test. There are other tests that are also fairly simple and easy. Let's say we're trying to decide whether the checkout page should have a blue background or a red background. You say, okay, we're going to run this for 2 weeks and we'll see how many people subscribe if there's a red background, how many people subscribe if there's a blue background. The complicated tests are, the most complicated tests have been where we put the paywall, right? Do you let people read 3 stories a month before you force them to subscribe? Do you let them read 2? Do you let them read 1? Do you make it seasonal so that you have a looser paywall at times where you have higher direct sold ad inventory? Do you adjust it based on the referral source of the people coming to the traffic, right? So there are about 50 variables that are interesting in the question of where you run your paywall. And that has been one of the main sources of experimentation for us as we've, you know, worked on changing the business. Then, of course, there's this very other interesting thing that happens. So let's say you realize from your tests that a tighter paywall brings in more revenue. Okay, well then what are the knock-on implications of that? Okay, well some of the knock-on implications are, if you're going to start tightening the meter, maybe you need to set up trial subscriptions. Maybe you need to figure out back doors for younger students who don't have disposable income so that they can get subscriptions and aren't, you know, blocked out by your paywall. So you end up running experiments that give you answers or point you in a certain direction. And then you also have to change the product so that it matches the direction you're going based on the result of the experiment.
That's a lot of changes to get people on board within the business. How did you go about sort of reassuring everybody, making sure that everybody's on board with some of the changes you wanted to make and the experiments?
Well, actually, that hasn't been a challenge. Lots of things have been challenging. But when everybody who works here at The Atlantic on the business side believes in the math, right? And if you go to a meeting and you say, you know what? We all thought the red background was going to work better, but you know what? The blue background works better. Everybody goes through the blue background. And if you say, you know what? We thought that building a meter that resets if 3,000 people have subscribed in the first 2 hours would do better than one that resets if 3,000 people have visited the story in the first 2 hours. Not 3,000 people subscribe in the first two story hours, then we're doing great. But regardless, if you say that we've tested this variable and it has shown this result, everybody goes along. So that's quite easy. The one part that was hard is that our tests and our experiments just continued to show that in most situations, in most cases with most stories, a tighter meter is better. And of course, there are objections to that because, well, maybe that reduces readership. Maybe it reduces the social benefit of your story. And so those are hard conversations where there are real values that are trade-offs. But there have been lots of tests where they're, you know, simple answers. This is better for the business if we change it. Everybody goes along.
And are there things that you learned from your time at Wired implementing the paywall there that you've been able to take over? Or are they two quite different businesses that you've had to approach in different ways?
They're quite different businesses. You know, Wired's business, the consumer revenue was a smaller percentage of the total revenue. You know, at Wired, we had three revenue sources. We had advertising, which was far and away the biggest. We had consumer revenue, and then we had affiliate revenue. So, you know, review headphones, people buy headphones, we get a commission. And the affiliate revenue was growing gangbusters when I was there. We launched the affiliate revenue and the paywall at roughly the same time. And I had expected the paywall to be 20x. The affiliate revenue wasn't at all the case. So back to the differences between the paywalls, there were a few things that were different. You know, the content that The Atlantic and Wired publish, like the sort of the type of content and the cadence of content is actually quite similar. But The Atlantic publishes obviously across a broader spectrum of stories, right? Publish across many different categories. And then there's another really important difference, which is that The Atlantic has far less of a history of vast discounting. And so one of the problems we had at Wired is that we had for years, you know, sold subscriptions at $5, right? Subscribe to The Atlantic for, you know, this July 4th special, holiday special, get Wired for a year for $1, right? And so the price in people's minds of what a Wired subscription cost was quite low. And so getting that high, getting the average order value up was, you know, nearly impossible, which of course, you know, you can have a million subscribers, but if they're paying you $10 each, it's not as good as having a million subscribers and they're paying you $70 each. So that was a big difference between the two. It's just the historical pricing at Wired.
I did notice you say in one interview, gosh, this was back in, I think, 2022, that you were hoping to get to a million subscriptions by then, but you sort of overestimated the Trump bump. Do you think there's likely to be another sort of election boom this year in terms of subscriptions, or do you think people are just a little bit kind of subscriptioned out at the moment?
That's a good question. So the, you know, the subscription arc here was the number of subscribers grew dramatically during the COVID years and during the 2020 election. We published some incredible stories. And then it stalled out, right? Readership started to decline significantly, you know, both because Biden presidency is not as exciting to Americans as Trump presidency, because the social platforms started to deprioritize news on their platforms. That was a complexity we had to deal with. So we have far fewer readers. And so in 2021, the total number of subscribers to The Atlantic at points, I don't know whether year over year it increased or declined, but it was certainly flat. It was not, the business was not going well. We were publishing great stories. We just weren't, our traffic wasn't as high and we weren't, our subscriptions weren't growing. And so it was around then that we started to make a lot of changes, right? Offering the trial subscriptions, changing the way the paywall worked, all the pricing tests, the product selection page, right? All of the nuts and bolts of how you get people to subscribe, right? The number of words you show them on the story before you ask them to subscribe, right? The way that page loads, all those things. Back to your question about a potential Trump bump. So now we go into the 2024 election. My guess is that there's not remotely as big a Trump bump as there was the last time. We've noticed that, you know, we publish lots of stories about Donald Trump because he's an important factor in American politics. We have amazing political writers. Those stories are read. It's not like it was 4 years ago or 8 years ago. I think there's a certain amount of fatigue with Trump. And so when I model out the economics for the rest of the year, I assume a small increase in traffic, maybe slightly larger than small, but not a huge increase in traffic. Maybe a modest increase in subscriptions and a major decline in advertising because every advertiser wants to avoid the chaos of the election. And so, you know, I think our revenue will probably be fairly stable across the year, you know, maybe a little increase in consumer because there's more attention and maybe a decrease in advertising when we get, you know, close to the election.
You said you didn't have a third revenue stream. The Atlantic used to have quite a huge events team, didn't it? It used to have like 120 or something events a year.
Yeah, I roll that revenue into advertising.
Okay.
So all the revenue that comes from events rolls into our advertising revenue. So you could, I mean, you can split it out if you want. You can say it's a different revenue stream. And kind of it is because it's a different content stream. But we're selling advertisements to, you know, often the same companies that we're selling direct sold, you know, web advertisements mm-hmm. to. So we roll it in. It is also true that we did used to have a much bigger events business. And we, as you saw reported, it, you know, it was closed down during COVID and we've restarted it. It's wonderful. It's great. It is a 20% of our advertising revenue, somewhere around there, I'm going to guess, 25. And then advertising is, you know, less than 50% of our overall revenue. So it's important. It's huge. It's great. It's really well run. Our events are amazing. If you're in Washington for the Atlantic Festival this September 19th, you should come. Yeah, it rolls into that.
It strikes me there's this sort of theme that of maybe doing a little bit less, a little bit deeper. Would you say that's fair across the sort of editorial events and everything else?
Oh, it's 100% fair. I mean, that is the editorial philosophy of the Atlantic, which is they don't chase scale. You know, there are many more people who are employed, but there are not many more stories being published because the stories that are being published are all taking, you know, more time, more effort, more editing, more fact checking, more copy editing. There is a real focus on making everything that gets published to be the best that it possibly can. And I think the same is true across the board. You know, we're a pretty small shop, but the work we put out is pretty good. And I think that's been part of the success.
And does that reflect itself in the fact that people are happier to pay maybe $10, $15, $20 more than they would have done for a subscription a couple of years ago? Like, are they happy with the extra quality they're getting, I suppose?
I hope so. It certainly is the case that our brand perception is quite good. It certainly is the case that people are willing to pay more. It certainly is the case that our stories are of the highest quality. It's also true, though, that our stories were of the highest quality in 2021 when we had a sort of a drop in subscriptions. So there are a lot of factors that play into this. But I think actually the most important point is this, and it took me a little while to realize it when I came in, which is the way to run the Atlantic. When I came in, I kind of thought it was like, all right, let's come up with the perfect business model, and then we'll work in tandem with editorial and create the content that supports the perfect business model. That's not really it. It's let the editorial team do what they're going to do and then build the best business model you can with that as your baseline assumption. And so, you know, they are pursuing their editorial strategy, which I love. And we have built a business model that supports and sort of, you know, is downstream of that strategy.
To what extent is the success of the last couple of years been approaching it holistically? It's sort of, it's all about the paywall and testing and learning and bringing the ad business along with it, rather than just saying, we're going to improve the paywall just as a sort of single focus thing.
Yeah, no, it's been very important. You know, this place would not be profitable without the, you know, profits from the advertising business. The advertising business is absolutely essential. We've worked really hard to optimize it. We've got a great team working selling ads where they're hustling every day. It's integral. Now, advertising drove the Atlantic was, I don't know, 85% of its revenue 10 years ago. I'm guessing, but somewhere around there. And that's obviously changed, but the ad sales team is highly ambitious, highly motivated, and doing great work. And without them, we don't have any chance of being profitable.
You said that this year will be one of the most consequential for the business. I'm just curious about why, if if maybe the election, everything is, if everything's forecast around stability?
Well, you know, this year is going to be consequential for a couple of reasons. You know, one, you know, this is a year where we've made a turning point, right? Where we've gone from losing a lot of money to making a little bit of money. So that's important. And then the question is whether you can sustain that, right? Of course, the day after it's announced that we're profitable, there are a whole bunch of people in my office asking for, you know, new policies, let's say, that would maybe reduce our profitability. I joked, I remember, I don't know, back in the United States, there was a very brief moment where the budget was balanced and there was a surplus, right? There's a small surplus, but like the government figured out like 1,000 ways to spend the surplus and every expense was the surplus. And so every question, of course, is going to be, well, you know, now that we're profitable, should we use the money on this, 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 this? It's like, no, actually, we're going to do everything the same and try to stay profitable. So that's part of why I think this year is consequential, right? Because it's a turning point. But secondly, you know, the story of the business in this kind of media is a series of transformations. In the time that I've been in the business, this is probably, you know, maybe the third major transformation, right? Where when I started, everything was print and we gradually moved into digital, right? Then everything is digital. And then there's this moment where it's all social, it's all ad-based. And then that kind of shifts. And now it's new consumer-based, consumer-focused. And there's going to be another shift. And I don't know what the next thing is going to be, right? AI is going to be wrapped up in it, but I don't know exactly what it is. And so what we have to do at The Atlantic is, you know, we survived the print to digital transition. Some publishers didn't, right? We had a good strategy. We did a good job. You know, great credit to my predecessors. We were a little late into the consumer business. It took us a little while to figure out the paywall. It took us a little while to get it optimized, but now it's working. That's great. So we're going to, you know, make it through this stage. And now we're going to enter the AI stage. And we're either going to figure out the right strategy, who knows what it is, or we're not. And so the other reason it's consequential is because we're going to be like, we've kind of accomplished the first thing we have to do, and now we have to figure out what's coming and do that. So that's the other reason why it's consequential.
Does AI, at every single interview these days, it always comes back to AI. Does AI excite you or concern you when it comes to, I suppose, both The Atlantic's publishing and just the future of publishing generally?
It's both. It probably is more, slightly more terror than excitement, but I am deeply excited about it. I mean, the tools are amazing. They're going to change the way lots of stuff is done, and we're trying to figure them out just like everybody else. But, you know, the terror is, you know, the web's going to be turned upside down, right? Who knows what the web is even going to look like in 3 years? Who knows whether there are going to be 1,000 Atlantic clones that people are able to create with GPT-7, right, and Claude 5? You know, who knows where, how advertising will be created and where it goes? Like, there are all kinds of unknowns. So, you know, we are going through the obvious steps that you go through when you see this coming, right? You make sure you build more direct relationships. Make sure you're driving more people into your app. Make sure that you're doing all the things that you should be doing when you see what's coming. But they're it's unquestionably the case that 3 years from now, when I look back to the choices I'm making now, I'll be like, God, how did I not see that?
I think we'll all be saying that. But talking of it's not future-proofing, but I know newsletters are one of the things that a lot of people are looking to as a way of like taking that direct relationship back, owning that relationship. And I think you guys were at the forefront of that a couple of years ago when you hired some writers directly and sort of involved others in a scheme about bringing those newsletters exclusively to The Atlantic. How's that gone? Because I've not been able to find much out about that since.
Yeah, well, that may help you explain how that's gone. I mean, I can tell you the whole story there. I mean, it's very interesting. So when I came in, it seemed quite apparent at that moment that one of the biggest threats to The Atlantic was Substack and the various Substack competitors that were out there. And some of them have gone under since then. But at that moment, there were a number of competitors out there. And many of them were approaching our writers and saying, hey, look, you can make $1 million a year if you put your newsletter on our platform, right? Why work for The Atlantic, which pays you, you know, pays you in the six figures, right? When you can go to Substack and, you know, be in the nine figures. No, I'm just kidding. But like, where you can make a lot more money as an individual contributor. And well, how do you respond to that? You say, well, we have to build our own newsletter program that kind of combines the best of both worlds, that offers financial upside to people who, you know, have great newsletter followings, and also gives them the benefits of working at The Atlantic, right? The reason you want to work at The Atlantic as a writer is because you have the brand association, because you have the great editors, because you have the great social media promotion, because you have the incredible colleagues, like all those things come together. And so we tried to create a program that would combine the best of both worlds. And we were able to recruit a roster of writers. And I don't know whether we kind of got the incentives wrong, modeled out the audience wrong, whether we executed it slightly wrong, but it was like a moderate success, not a smashing success. The writers did well. Many of them still write for us. They've moved mostly into staff writer roles. We still have individual newsletters. The most interesting thing we found was that if people knew about the subscriber-only newsletter program, they were more likely to retain their subscription and not churn. Like just having it increased the sort of the value of an Atlantic subscription. So that was valuable. Ultimately, it was something where we put a lot of thought, a decent amount of time, a small amount of money, and it ended up bringing back, kind of broke even. We just then minimized it. You could have imagined a world where we invested heavily in it and said, you know what, we're going to bring in a roster of 20 people. But there were a lot of complexities with that. So, and then, circling back, the reason why we didn't quadruple the program or why you haven't heard much about it is that we've also, like, the risk of losing people into newsletter world has declined. And the economics of being an individual news writer have become more clear in that it's fabulous for some and very hard for others. And our writers have seen that too. And they're like, oh, wait, I can be paid a real salary, have real editors, publish on a certain cadence, have a guaranteed audience for the Atlantic. We can even write newsletters for the Atlantic, a new podcast and newsletter. And it works really well. For most writers, that's a much better deal than, oh my God, I've got to go off and start my own Substack and maybe I'm not going to make anything on it. So that's the nutshell history of our subscriber-only newsletter program.
Well, I mean, you've still got a very generous roster of newsletters anyway.
Oh, we have an amazing roster of newsletters and, your listeners sign up for all of them. Yeah, we have great writers who write them. Tom Nichols, who often writes our daily newsletter, he came in as somebody writing a subscriber-only newsletter. He's fantastic. We have individual people like Derek Thompson. People love Derek Thompson, right? They can read his newsletter. It's an Atlantic newsletter. So there are lots of great newsletters. We're launching new newsletters all the time. I mean, the future of newsletters is going to be complicated. It's going to be complicated by AI. So it is great to have direct relationships. Newsletters are direct relationships, right? If the web becomes this morass of AI-generated content, in the short term, which is of lower quality than the average human, but which in the long run will be much better quality, when the web becomes this like AI-generated mess, what will happen to digital publications? Who knows? But what happens also when email becomes like a chaotic mess and where there are, bot farms that can write human-sounding emails and harvest your email address and suddenly you're getting 900 emails a day from the various bot farms with, very sophisticated humans writing, actually pretty good emails. What will happen to a Thought Leader magazine's newsletter program? I think it'll still do well. I mean, certainly as far out in the future as I can see, it's going to be great, but who knows how that's going to change. So we continue to evolve it. We continue to invest in it. It continues to do really well. It's a great place for advertising. It's a great place for driving subscriptions. It's a great place for our writers. I love everything about newsletters, but, I'm not going to give you 100% guarantee that in the age of AI, that business will still thrive.
No, I suppose it's just interesting to hear how that one ended up. You did mention retention and newsletters being part of retention. I guess retention is probably fairly high up the list of concerns this year. Yeah. You've got this million subscribers. What sort of things are you looking at in order to keep that number steady and growing?
Retention is huge. Like the more subscribers you have, right? So the more subscribers you have, the more people you have to retain, the higher the churn numbers are, the higher the number of people you have to bring in every day. So we are studying a lot of factors. Back to the question you asked at the very beginning of this, like how long do your tests run? It is also the case that sometimes you run a test which lets you make a short-term decision and you don't know what the long-term implications are and you guess. But then it takes a while to get the data. So for example, we had never had trial subscriptions, right? Read this story, get a free month at the Atlantic, and then we ask you to subscribe for a year. We don't know what the long-term retention rates of people who come in from trials versus the people who come in from same-day starts are, right? Because we only launched our trials in, September of 2022? And so we have, now we have 7 months of those people coming up on a year on. So, you know, what will be their churn rate in the second year of their subscription, right? We have no way of knowing that, you know. We launched more aggressive paid marketing, you know, in the past year. What will be the churn rate of the people who came in through that? So a lot of times you run experiments and you model out and you guess, and then a year later or 2 years later, you get the full data on the retention and the therefore the lifetime value of the readers. So, you know, we're still getting that. But back to your question, yes, huge priority. Yes, we try to figure out all the mechanisms that make someone less likely to churn, right? We have a model that analyzes every action and tells us, you know, what are the things that are most associated with not churning, right? Well, signing up for a newsletter is obviously one, like reading multiple stories on the site is obviously one. Reading stories across different categories of content, you know, is a valuable factor. Getting people into your app is a valuable factor. And so what we do, without revealing the whole strategy, because it's very secret and very good, is we look at all of those factors that are most likely to reduce churn and then try to build products, you know, introduce nudges, do whatever we can to improve those variables.
One thing that did jump at me from, I think it's the Wall Street Journal piece that came out around your milestone, was that you were seeing quite a bit of success with Apple News Plus.
Yeah.
I think it said you had around 100,000 users. You said that the Atlantic gets roughly the same amount of revenue from people in Apple as direct subscribers. I'm fascinated to know how that, is that because people spend a lot of time with the Atlantic and Apple, so they have to compensate you quite a lot for it?
Well, okay. So, I mean, maybe we should give a warning to the listeners that it's going to get pretty complicated here. So we have lots of readers in Apple News, not as many as there are on the Atlantic website, but it's fairly close. And in fact, the number of people who read Atlantic stories in Apple News, you know, continues to climb and is huge, right? And so any given day, you don't have quite as many people reading the Atlantic on Apple News as you do on the site, but you got a lot. What Apple News counts as a subscriber, though, is not somebody who reads an Atlantic story. It's not somebody who follows the Atlantic. It's actually somebody who clicks on the PDF of our issue within Apple News. So what I was saying in that interview is that if you take the total amount of revenue that we generate from Apple News each year and divide it by the number of people that they count as subscribers, that number is roughly equal to our subscription price. It doesn't mean that we're getting as much per reader in Apple News as we are per reader on our site or per reader of our magazine. It just means that based on the kind of complicated factors that Apple News to count as a subscriber, it sort of works out to what we count as a subscriber. Now, the general part of Apple News is that our revenue is increasing. The way Apple News counts revenue is based on the time that people spend reading your stuff. And so they take the total amount of money that they get from Apple News Plus subscribers. They then look at the time that all those people spent reading different publications. They then apportion some of the money they keep for themselves, some of the money they share with us. The money they share with us, they apportion based on the time. You know, we have lots of good stories. We have lots of long stories. We have lots of stories people read beginning to end, which means that we do reasonably well on this metric of time. So we get a reasonably large fraction, and many more people are subscribing to Apple News. So we are getting a reasonably large fraction of a growing pool of money. That has been quite helpful to us.
But I guess there's still an incentive there for you to try and convince them to subscribe to you rather than
definitely
just read the old story through Apple News.
You know, we do not put all of our content on Apple News, right? You can't read our archival stories. Like, there are lots of things you can't read even if you have an Apple News Plus subscription. There are many reasons to become an Atlantic subscriber. You can't get the print edition. You know, lots of our stories you only get if you are an Atlantic subscriber. That said, I don't know. I was just talking to my sister. She's an Atlantic subscriber and an Apple News Plus subscriber. And she reads us in both places. Like, bless her heart. Like, I love those people. But what we want is, you know, our first priority is we'd like them to be Atlantic subscribers. And then, you know, regardless, if they are an Apple News Plus subscriber, we'd like them to read Atlantic stories there.
As someone who is constructively dissatisfied, what are your next goals for the business now that 1 million subscribers have been reached?
Yeah, that's actually one of the most important questions. You can't quite see it, but if I were to pan my camera, I have the strategic plan of the Atlantic with all of my problems and priorities in sticky notes on my wall. And, you know, in part of it is the question of what the next goal should be, right? I don't know what the next goal should be, right? You can imagine, like, maybe we should have 2 million subscribers. But that's not quite it. And it's going to be a while until we get to 2 million subscribers. And so I'm trying to work through what the next goal should be. And I'm very conscious of the fact that whatever you set as the goal for a company incentivizes people to get there. sometimes not doing things that are good for, you know, the company as a whole, right? If we had only had a goal of getting to 1 million subscribers and not a goal of 1 million subscribers and profitability, like there are all kinds of things we could have done. We just run paid marketing or offer discounts, give people Atlantic for a dollar, right? You can get to 1 million subscribers very quickly. So it was the twinning of the profitability and 1 million subscribers that actually put us into a good place and incentivized good behavior. And so what I need to do is to come up with a goal that does, you know, that incentivizes good behavior and gets us to wherever we need to go next.
Not giving too much away there.
Yeah. I mean, I have lots of ideas, but they're mostly bad. So I don't know what the good idea will be. What should it be?
Oh, gosh. Why not increase the time people spend with it?
Well, okay. So a couple of reasons. It's a little complicated to measure time, right? And do you measure time by the total amount of time people spend reading the articles on our website multiplied together? Well, no, it's super interesting, right? Yeah. I only give the example because then you can see different behaviors. Okay, so then is it better to have one person reading 10 stories or three people reading 3 stories each, right? And if you're just measuring time, it's better to have one person reading 10. My favorite perverse incentive of the time spent metric is that actually if you were fully optimizing to maximize the time someone spends on a story, you would edit the piece so that it's crystal clear until the very end, and then you would make it extremely confusing. And then you would my point is there's just all kinds of complicated incentives.
Yeah.
I mean, time spent is a really good one. It's one that I've care a lot about. And in fact, when I was at the New Yorker and in Condé Nast, I pushed really hard to make it a metric that was more integral to the way our performance was assessed.
I think if you're talking about coupling, I would probably couple time spent with daily habit. So if somebody's mm-hmm. reading 3 articles a day every day, you're not going to lose them anytime soon.
Yep.
And those are the people you want to form the core of your business. Whereas if it's just somebody spending 10 hours reading a piece, they're maybe not quite as valuable.
Yep. And in fact, the daily habit is, that is a huge part going back to one of the other questions you asked about retention, right? And so we used to call it the habit pod, trying to figure out what exactly are the things that lead to making the Atlantic more of a habit, right? And I think that's what the New York Times has done so well is, and that's, you know, I think they, you know, they studied this question. Then they sort of found like, what are the secondary hobbies or secondary interests of your primary readers, right? And so then they identified games and cooking. And so then they, you know, built up those verticals through acquisition, through their own good work, and then created a habit, right? So now people go to the Times to do Wordle, and then they, you know, read the news. And actually, weirdly, I think they now spend more time playing games than they do reading the news.
Because we talked about this on the podcast last week, is that's fine to have those products and to do those products well, but are they a gateway to then actually reading the news product? And does that matter? Does it need to be? But I think probably for the Atlantic, it probably does.
Well, I mean, actually, the scariest view would be, what if it's not, in the ideal version, it's a gateway, right? You play the game, then you read the stories. In the worst case, it's a substitute, right? Like, instead of reading the stories, you play the game. And so you have to really avoid that. So if we go into games, we're going to try very hard to not make it a substitute for reading our reporting.
Yeah.
But the Times has been, you know, brilliant at doing this, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to do that too. But, you know, and you're totally right. Like, if I were to say, you know, the whole goal of the company is going to be focused around increasing the number of people who visit the Atlantic 3 times a week, right? You would see a lot of innovation and a lot of energy being invested in a different area than if I said, okay, everyone, the goal is to get to 1.5 million subscribers, right? You'll just see totally different behaviors, you know, all of which are good and lead in a good direction, but which are somewhat different in interesting ways.
If you enjoyed that interview with Nick, we'd love you to stay in touch with us. You can follow the Media Voices podcast wherever you're listening to it to get updated when we next release an episode. We're on a break now from regular programming, but we'll have occasional episodes out before our next season in September. We also have a daily newsletter bringing you the top 4 media and publishing stories you need to know on everything from subscription strategies to AI developments, print, regulations, and more. You can sign up for that on our website, voices.media. Hopefully we'll catch you at our summit, or we'll be back in your ears soon. Goodbye.